Judge Brathwaite, Judge Rodenberg, Judge Riley, the Honorable Judge Diane Brathwaite presiding.
Good morning. Let's all be seated. Good morning again, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the record, let me just state that today's date is March 13th, 2019. We have six matters on our calendar today, one by ITV. Two of those are non-oral, so four are oral matters. We have, that looks like, counsel for the first matter sitting at table this morning, and so I'll ask the marshal to call our first case.
Case A18-1405, Bruce K. Rankler, Realtor versus Fairview Health Services Respondent and Department of Economic and Employment Economic Development Respondent.
And before counsel for appellant proceeds with the argument, let me just make a few comments to everyone. First of all, we're looking forward to our conversation today, and I just want to remind everyone, you probably know this because you're here often, but our podium is adjustable, so take that time to make it adjustable and comfortable for you. It goes up and down. And of course, the microphone, just like I'm doing right now, can be moved around as well and makes it easier for us to hear you. So we appreciate if you take the time to make those adjustments. Secondly, I just want to remind you to make sure that you do identify yourselves for the record, so state your name clearly as well as the client that you're here representing. And then you can proceed with your argument. We look forward to hearing from you. So counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court. Thank you for inviting me here this morning. My name is Attorney Jasper Berg. I represent the appellant, Mr. Bruce Rankler. This case is about Mr. Rankler being eligible for unemployment benefits. The issue in this case is whether or not Mr. Rankler quit his job or was discharged. The unemployment law judge in this case heard this case. There were two phone hearings, and the unemployment law judge had decided that as of August 25th, Mr. Rankler had quit his job. This morning, Mr. Rankler asks this court to review the decision, of course, and reduce the overpayment of approximately $15,800 because of an error of law and the record not supporting the decision. The most significant fact in this case that was not identified in the decision is in relationship to Mr. Rankler's job change to casual employment.
I was going to ask you about that. I'm not familiar with that term. Could you tell me what it is, please?
Sure. The answer is it's an undefined term. The only definition that we have for it is based on what the employer had said to the appellant.
So is it a job classification that is particular to Fairview Health Services?
The record does not identify that this is a specific classification of job. This job did have responsibilities, and it did have some duties. And let me just refer to the record real fast. So what do we know about casual status? What is that job entail? And in general, it was supposed to start, I'll turn your attention to the transcript of page 12 and page 13. And this is what the employer identified as this position. And this is coming from the chief of human resources for the employer. My client happens to be a person with a learning disability, and the record doesn't say this specifically, but he was relying on the employer, their words, their actions in defining this role. Okay. can't necessarily find it right away in my notes, but ultimately this was a position where he was offering support to the employer by phone from a distant, is how the record reads.
I guess what I'm trying to understand to follow up on Judge Riley's question is it seems as though the casual status employment was quite different. The duties were different from what the position that Mr. Rankula had prior to August 25th. Isn't that right?
That is correct. The duties were significantly different.
And as I understand it, but I could have the record wrong, so correct me. If Mr. Rankula performed duties as a casual status employee, he would get paid. But if he didn't perform duties, he would not get paid. Is that right? There were no set number of hours, I guess, is what I'm trying to say in a casual way.
The record doesn't identify how many hours Mr. Rankula was supposed to work. However, there are exhibits that say that Mr. Rankula worked 40 hours per week.
Well, there are exhibits saying he got paid after August 25th, but I believe his statement in the record, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, but his record, his statement, testimony during the hearing was that that was severance pay from Fairview, which is quite different. Obviously, severance pay is quite different from being paid for this casual status employment.
So, I would agree. Severance pay is a different issue. I am relying on the words and actions of the employer. There was some sort of payment in the month of October, approximately October 9th.
Well, yeah, there were the vacation benefits, right? Is that the one you're referring to?
Correct.
Because, of course, I mean, for other reasons, he's entitled to a payment for that. You know, whether he, upon discharge, certainly, but upon acquit as well, he would be entitled to payment for those vacation benefits, wouldn't he?
There's no correlation between quitting a job and being automatically eligible for PTO payment, but this employer treated it that way.
Okay, so let's. I know that's not an issue that was litigated in front of the ULJ, so I wanted to say as little as possible, except to identify that the October payment related to his vacation benefits, right?
That's how I understand it, correct.
Okay, so it seems like that's separate, right?
That was a separate payment, and the department reviewed that as a separate issue.
And it doesn't really support your, I think, your contention that that Mr. Rankula got paid as a casual status employee.
That's correct. And this is coming from the employer's wage auditor. As I understand it, some relationship to the employer, and they identified 40 hours per week. Every week leading through September 22nd.
So what do we do with that testimony from Mr. Rankula that that was a severance payment by Fairview? The 40 hours a week until, I don't have the date right in front of me, September, I think.
Sure. So your question is?
Mr. Rankula testified that that was severance pay. So again, I don't understand how that would support your contention that Mr. Rankula continued to be employed as a casual status and paid as a casual status employee.
Sure. I don't think we're the.
Did he receive payment as a casual status employee?
Yes.
Okay. Well, there's testimony that he didn't. Page 13, Ms. Neary is asked, was he to be paid on casual status? Answer, no. So he wasn't paid after that date. And then it sounds like that's where he got this other payment. And that it wasn't payment for casual status, according to Ms. Neary.
According the way I interpreted the record on page 13 of the transcript, the question was he paid after August 26th? And Ms. Neary replied, he did receive regular pay through September 22nd.
But that seems like that's different than the way, at least than the way I interpret Ms. Neary's testimony. It seems like she's saying this casual status was unpaid unless they called him in or called him up to help a new employee or to help with some problem that arose, and then he'd get some additional money that wasn't paid here. That's the way I read it.
That wasn't my interpretation of the facts. I don't think the record ever said that the casual status was unpaid.
Ms. Neary said it. Was he to be paid on casual status? Answer, no.
What we have here is a conflict between three witnesses of the employer. Okay, the chief human resources officer, the employee manager, labor manager, Ms. Neary, and the wage auditor, the person who's, I would suppose, responsible for reviewing wages. They all had a different storyline.
And you would agree that your client was paid over $1,000 for those weeks leading, for the 4 weeks after termination. Do you agree with that? He received weekly payments, as I understand it.
He...
For a while.
Correct. Okay. There were wages earned.
So then my question for you has to do with what's contained in the appendix to the...
Sure.
And I'm looking at pages A10 and following, but your client filled out questions for unemployment. And please answer the following questions carefully for the week of 8/27 through 9/2. Did you work or have paid holiday during the reporting period listed? No. And so that seems to conflict with the other evidence that was in front of the judge.
Sure. Here's the answer. Here's the answer. And it's a three-part answer. Number one, the department identified exhibits that weren't part of the record. The first time I ever saw that was in the appendix.
The first time you saw it is in this addendum attached to the red brief? Okay, go ahead.
Correct. Number two, the department is trying to use the M word, which is misrepresentation. Not only is that a blatant violation of due process for my client to just throw that out there, but that issue had already been decided by the department. And if I were to submit those records openly, that would be a huge problem because it'd be unfair to my client long-term. I have those records, I brought them. That issue was decided by the department. And there were some miscommunications that the department ultimately decided that that was not an issue. And they reviewed my client's deductible earnings as a different issue, is what you were referring to earlier. So what I'm saying to you is, in the appendix, I don't know what the result is, but I have records to say that that is not an issue, and those records come from the department. And had they done their due diligence and submitted that, they would have seen it. But they chose not to. And
you're saying that we should strike that portion of the addendum because it's not part of the record.
Number one, it's not part of the record. Number two, it wasn't an issue reviewed by this particular judge. And number three, those issues were already resolved as moot. And I have records to show that.
The first part I understand completely. Your request that we not consider materials outside the record makes a lot of sense to me. But I'm struggling a little bit with the last part where you say that, you know, this is an issue that wasn't in front of the ULJ. I think it was. I mean, the ULJ had to determine whether Mr. Ankle acquit or was discharged, and if so, on what date. And we do have a determination of discharge.
Correct. I was referring to
acquit. Acquit on a certain date. So that was definitely in front of the ULJ, and of course, Mr. Rankula did have an obligation to put forth relevant evidence,
of course,
as to whether he, on what date he quit, and whether he continued working, and in what capacity. Right.
He was putting forth evidence on what day he was discharged.
That's his theory, right? But I mean, certainly to respond.
Of course,
correct.
That was the issue that this ULJ reviewed, correct, right. Was the quit or discharge.
And I guess that's what brings me back to it. It seems to me as though, you know, and I, again, maybe I'm just misunderstanding Mr. Rankla's testimony. He definitely says many things about misunderstandings, right, with Fairview. So, but he also clearly states a few things, one of which is that he thought that sometime in the future Fairview would discharge him. And he also says that these payments he received were in severance.
The
So I need to have a way of, that seems to me those pieces of Mr. Rankle's testimony support the ULJ's determination, and I just need to understand how what your view is on that evidence.
My view is that the reason why there's an error of law is because the error of law was not applying the discharge law. The discharge law looks at the employer's words and actions. It doesn't look at Mr. Rankle's words and actions. Certainly Mr. Rankle's words and actions are relevant, but the discharge rule, which the unemployment law judge did not apply, defers to the employer's words and actions. And the employer's words and actions coming from their three main witnesses here. And so that's why there was an error of law. And even if, and of course, Mr. Rankle doesn't believe that he quit his job just based on his health and his requirement for health insurance. That just was not a choice for him. But the reason why I believe that the unemployment law judge made an error of law is because the discharge rules use the phrase quit. And using that word, that law is still required to look at the employer's words and actions, not Mr. Rankle's. And ultimately, that's why this case should be reversed, is because of the discharge rule, not the quit rules that were applied by the unemployment law judge. And I know you have this in the brief, and so I'm not suggesting that you don't, but in the limited time that I do have, Minnesota Statute 268.095, paragraph A and paragraph D are the rules of law that allow this court to reverse this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. And of course, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Of course. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Carrie Phillips, and I represent the respondent, the Department of Employment and Economic Development. So it is well settled that whether an applicant quit or was discharged is a question of fact. The unemployment law judge here made a finding of fact that the applicant quit his employment because he believed he would be discharged in the future. And this finding is supported by reasonable evidence in the record, including the applicant's own testimony about the conversations with the employer's witnesses. Instead of going through that evidence, I'll go to the issue of the casual status at this time. And if you have any questions about the evidence, I can circle back. So
I do have a question.
Okay.
Is Mr. Jasper correct that the documents contained in your addendum were not part of the record?
The questionnaires, he is correct that the questionnaires are not part of the record. And the reason for that is that below the applicant did not testify that he worked past August 25th. So the judge didn't develop the record on whether he continued to work after that point. So the applicant never argued that he was discharged in October or December. The applicant never testified that he worked after August 25th. So I think that the parties agreed that his employment ended on August 25th. And so that's why that wasn't developed. But he is correct in that they weren't received into evidence. So with regard to the casual status, we have the testimony of Ms. Neary that this was an arrangement so that if the applicant was needed to answer questions for his replacement, that the employer could pay him for that time spent. The testimony is that he did not work any hours after August 25th, nor was he paid any wages after August 25th. So in essence, the casual status was like on-call employment. He was available to answer questions and he would be paid. But
is there any more explicit definition of that in anything that's in the record?
There is just Ms. Neary's testimony that she testifies it was a kind of arrangement.
Right, I've seen that, but okay. I mean, is there like a employee handbook or a contract or a something more than Ms. Neary's testimony, which I'm not criticizing the testimony, but there's some gaps in the testimony as to exactly what that is.
There is not. And again, I would say in the hearing below, it wasn't brought up that he was discharged at a later point, that the casual status was employment. So this is kind of a new way of looking at it. The applicant wasn't testifying that he was discharged or that he was working during the casual status period. He testified that his last day was August 25th, and that's consistent with his answers in the questionnaires that are in the exhibits. I believe, you know, he puts that his notice, you know, lasted through August 25th. So it just wasn't fully developed. So that may be part of the evidentiary issue about casual status. So we just know that it's kind of like an on-call employment, and he wasn't actually called in, so he wasn't, we would argue he wasn't employed during that period of time. Our definition of employment in 268 is providing services. That's part of the definition, and the applicant did not provide any services after August 25th, nor did he, was he paid any wages.
If casual status was like on call, like sometimes nurses, police officers, fire people have, they get paid for that. So it's not evident without a further definition that it isn't providing some service, the service of being available.
And I do have some case law that's relevant to that point. It's cited in the brief. There's the case Hoganson versus Knox Builders. This interpreted a different version of our statute, but in that case, this court upheld the finding that the applicant quit when he chose to go to on-call part-time employment from a full-time, regularly scheduled position. He chose to go on-call part-time, and this court...
Was that paid on-call time?
No, it was not paid. So, I mean, that may be...
So is.
Yes, and that may be a distinction. He was not paid for being on-call. He wasn't paid for the casual status time here. The payments that he was paid, I believe, as Judge Riley noted, or I'm sorry, somebody noted that he was paid some vacation payout on October 9th, and then he received some severance pay. And so the testimony on this is Neary testified that they continued to pay him his regular salary for 4 additional weeks as a soft landing. That's the words that she used. And the applicant testified that he was paid severance. In the second hearing, he testified that that was part of the consideration for choosing to resign at that time, that if he chose to leave at that time, he would get his vacation paid out, he would get severance, he would get health benefits paid through the end of the year, and unemployment, because he testified he was told that he would get unemployment. So that was actually, you know, part of the reason that he chose to end his employment at that time was because he did get some severance pay. There is no evidence in the record supporting.
So when you say that was part of Mr. Rankla's decision in choosing to quit, is that clear from his testimony?
Yes, I believe it is. So in the second hearing, he testified that he was told if he left, he would get PTO paid out, he'd get unemployment benefits, and he would get health care through the end of the year. So that's why he chose that. I can get a cite to the
Yeah,
record,
if you just
like
happen
that.
To have it handy, I'd appreciate it. If you don't worry about it. But I heard you say PTO, and I heard you say health benefits. I didn't hear
yes.
you say continuation of regular pay. Did I just miss that?
No, he didn't say continuation of regular pay.
Okay.
No.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's looking on page 49 of the record, or excuse me, of the transcript. There's some testimony on that. He testifies, if I stayed, we'll pay out all your PTO, which I had a lot of. They said, I asked about unemployment. They said, you'll get your unemployment. I asked, will you be able to extend my health care till the end of the year, until I find another job? So he's talking about the conversation that they had. He referred to the choice, you know, as either the hard way or the easy way. The hard way being going through the process of further corrective action, the easy way being getting the severance package that he ended up receiving. So.
And you said that was the transcript of the second hearing.
Yes. This page 49 of the transcript. And I believe in the first transcript, he mentions getting PTO paid out and unemployment benefits as well. So there is no evidence that he was paid wages for work after August 25th. So in sum,
let me ask you about the concluding point that was raised by appellant's counsel in his argument. And I understand certainly why you refer us to the case law that says that when an employee expresses an understanding that he or she will be discharged in the future, that doesn't make it a discharge when he quits now. So I understand why you're doing that. On the other hand, I think appellant's counsel is pushing back a bit in saying that because our standard for determining the law on determining whether an employee has quit or discharged is really based on the employer's conduct and words, not on the subjective belief of an employee. And he is, of course, not referring to his own statements to support his contention that he was discharged. You know, what does this court look at in the record to determine that Mr. Rankel, in fact, was acquit, not a discharge?
Sure.
In terms of the employer's words and conduct.
The employer's words. Okay, well, looking at the quit analysis, of course, is you're looking at evidence that he made the decision to end his employment when it ended. So, interrupt me if I'm not answering your question, but the evidence showing that he made the decision to end his employment is evidence of the conversation being presented, the two options, his statement that I don't want to work where I'm not wanted, the testimony that, well, you think about this, we'll follow up with you on the 14th, and then the testimony that they went through the process of a transition plan and benefits, and that he never said anything to the effect of, I'm not quitting. So they believed that he was resigning this entire time, and he never said that he wasn't. With regard to the analysis of discharge, you are correct that you look at the employer's actions or statements that would lead a reasonable employee to believe that they could no longer work there. And there just isn't anything in the record that Fairview said or did that would cause a reasonable employee to believe that they could no longer work there. You know, he had that option. And he had the choice, and he made the decision to resign at that time. In the brief, I believe applicant argues that the conduct that was the discharge was the payout of vacation, the payment on October 9th of vacation, that was the discharge event. And so receiving a vacation payout would not lead a reasonable employee to believe that he could no longer work there. I mean, he had already quit at that point. So the quit happened when the applicant decided that he was going to end his employment instead of going down that process of corrective action. And the employer's actions after that were just, you know, wrapping up his employment and transitioning him out of that. So there is no conduct from the employer that fits the definition of a discharge. So in sum, there is reasonable evidence in the record to support the finding that the applicant quit his employment because he believed he would be discharged in the future. Our statute says that is still a quit if you're told that you're going to be discharged in the future. Even if that's a sure thing, if you decide to end it before then, that is a quit under our statute. And the record also shows that the applicant does not meet any of the exceptions to ineligibility for quitting. And therefore, he is ineligible for unemployment benefits. So the department respectfully requests that the court affirm the decision. So if there's no other questions, I can conclude. All right, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Berg, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you for an opportunity for a rebuttal. Very quickly, in the speed round here, this court has a very difficult decision because you're balancing between the employer's words and actions and what you heard described from Mr. Rankla. Mr. Rankla did not quit his job. The department's brief identifies a case where they want to apply this rule very strictly. And I believe that was the Supreme Court case that they identified from 1943. excuse me, in the Hodgkins case. Stand by. As I'm trying to find the case that the department identified, this court can...
Are you talking about Hoganson?
Well, the point I was trying to make is in reference to Minnesota Statute 268.031. And that rule is basically this court is supposed to favor awarding unemployment benefits because unemployment benefits are remedial in nature. This particular statute came after the case that the department was identifying about applying rules strictly. In other words, this rule did not exist at the time that the court was reviewing that decision. That's the rule of law that I wanted to bring to your attention. But most significantly, when it comes to the review of this discharge, the applicant depended on his health insurance. He never would have jeopardized his own health, which was severe with the disease that he does have. He absolutely would never quit his job. And so he was going into this casual status. This came after the August 25th. The fact that he wasn't physically at work is different from being on casual status. Casual status does not suggest, nor does a record, I'd say that it was required for him to be physically at work. The employer has very mixed up facts. They use the acronym LDW, very likely meaning last day of work, being September 22nd of the year 2017. That does contradict what the employer's witnesses were saying on the phone during this unemployment appeal hearing. But all we really have is that if we're relying on the employer, the one fact that they can all agree on was that Mr. Rankula was on casual status. And no employer that I know of is just going to pay an employee to sit at home and do nothing unless they are getting something from it, especially a sophisticated employer like Fairview. So that fact pattern is what I'm trying to bring to your attention. I guess in the remaining time that I do have, Mr. Rankula is very grateful that his case is being heard. And again, he's asking this court to review the eligibility of his benefits and to reverse the original decision, which, by the way, the employer decided not to participate in after the first hearing. I think that does have some sort of weight in this case as well. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Our thanks to both counsel for this matter. So it is now submitted to the court for its decision. We will issue a decision within the statutory time frame. So thank you.